Just like us, comedian Doug Benson loves movies so much he made a podcast about it. Now you can hear all 8 seasons of Doug Loves Movies on Stitcher Premium, plus hear bonus episodes and the Benson Interruption completely ad-free. That's over 1,000 hours of Doug Benson talking about movies for just $4.99 a month or $34.99 a year. Start listening now with a 1-month free trial of Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcherpremium.com/Doug and use promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your free month. That's stitcherpremium.com/Doug and use promo code CRACKED. Hello, movie lovers. Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club, the podcast where we look at movies ranging from classic to not so classic and aim to make you an undisputable expert in them. I'm one of your hosts, Tom Ryman.
I'm Abe Epperson.
And here with us today is Cracked podcast guru and all-around delightful human man, Alex Schmidt.
Oh, hey. Thanks, guys. Yeah. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
And
thanks
he's frankly an all-around delightful human being, if I don't say so.
Oh, hey. Yeah. That's too many compliments. I can't get going.
It's too many
that.
Of the same compliments.
Oh, man.
That's enough about Alex. Today we're talking about E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Right, yeah. We're continuing on our Spielberg month.
Yeah. Every 4 weeks or so, we're going to change up what director we talk about, but Spielberg, this is the Spielberg podcast for right now.
Yeah, and Spielberg July, right? That's the whole thing.
Right.
And at the end of Spielberg this, lie. You'll hear where we're going. We might be any other number of directors. We're crazy. So, Alex, before we begin, please give a synopsis. It can be short as you like, long as you like, a summary of the film. Yeah. You watched it recently.
E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Yes. I watched. I realized I was watching it for the second time ever. Like, this movie was not a touchstone of my childhood. Like, I had seen it, but I was like, oh, yeah, E.T., great. So it was cool to, like, see it again. Summary of the film. Alien ship gets caught visiting Earth. They leave a crewman behind as they flee, and then the crewman becomes, like, a kid's dad, sort of, and then dies and comes back to life and leaves.
Like, you mean he gives birth to a child?
Oh, you know.
Becomes a surrogate father.
In an adoptive sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's
pretty succinct.
Yeah,
pretty
that's
on
a good
point.
Sum up.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So on this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary summaries. Feel free to join us in a segment that we like to call Terrible Log Lines.
I love this song.
Yeah, no, this is the best. I'll start you up. A government agent vows to never lose his keys again.
Alien Jesus goes on the best bike ride ever.
An alien plies a young boy with alcohol into committing entry-level sexual assault. Aliens fucking love candy.
Stranger Things, but way less horrific. Also, everything's gonna be fine for everyone.
The government turns a sad family's house into a cool-ass tube tent.
Yeah.
It is a pretty bitchin' tent.
And that's awesome. Ends our segment.
That's it.
Terrible log lines.
Terrible log lines. I would see every movie based on any one of these log lines.
Yeah, no, they're like, all fucking
any
great.
One of these, if that was a log line of that movie, I'd be like, well, I gotta check this
Alien
out.
Alien Jesus might be my favorite.
Oh, right. Hey.
Yeah.
Well, I like that the movie is at least, I don't know, 50% a comedy or 30% a comedy, and yet you can do such funnier log lines of it.
Right.
Right.
The actual log line is kind of grim. It's like he's all alone, he's afraid, and he's like 13 million light years from home or something.
Right. But it's like a lot of bits. It's a lot of like, oh, now he's dressed in a wig.
Right.
Yeah. He's running around.
Yeah. Halloween just happens to be at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's dress him up and take him out because you wouldn't leave an alien at home for that. Yeah.
We'll get into it.
Abe, you had a pretty good E.T. in your pocket right there.
Thank
that
you.
Was great.
Thank
solid,
you.
Solid.
I've been practicing at home.
It's not an impression you get to whip out that often. So you really want to make sure it's honed to a fine craft.
Well, what I love about E.T. is that he's got a few. Like, he has the mid-tone, but he also has like a low purr, and he's got a high screech.
He definitely, we'll get into that. Yeah, he is a creature of many vocal hats. Wears lots of them. Now that we've talked about the plot of the movie, we'd like to get into a segment where we talk about how the movie was made, in a segment we call Expensive Pretending. Very expensive.
It's true. That's what filmmaking is.
Right, yeah. We're just lots of money on make-believe. So yeah, the script for E.T. Came from Spielberg had the idea for a while to make a short film about divorce because his family had gone through divorce when he was a teenager and he had younger siblings that he sort of had to take care of when his dad took off. And while he was making Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he had the idea to make a movie based on, like, well, what if one of those aliens just stayed and hung out and became a person? And so that sort of started the genesis of the idea for making E.T.
And it's definitely about that. It's about loss. It's about gain. It's very in this... very much so the Spielberg hat. In fact, there's a quote that you talked about, his parents' divorce in 1960. Spielberg said of, he said that the his imaginary alien, and this was before E.T. was E.T., when he was just talking, he's been quoted, he always thought of him as, quote, a friend who could be the brother I never had and a father that I didn't feel I had anymore.
Oh, right, because...
Super, like, dark shit right there.
Well, and it's dark, but then it makes sense when you look at all of his movies. Like, so many of his movies deal with estranged or absent fathers.
Yeah, many times in this podcast have we mentioned about Spielberg is he always felt like an outsider. He was making films for a WASP culture, and he was a Jew. So it's like he never felt like he was in. And this is something he's commented about, is that especially at the start of his career, he was didn't feel like he was involved or a participant in his own culture.
And that was part of what made him nervous about this film. Not only was it kind of smaller, it's funny to think of E.T. as being a small film, but it only had a budget of like $10 million.
Yeah.
But it's sort of an effects movie because there's a lot of effects in it and there's a whole creature that they had to create, but it is this small, much smaller scale film and all he had done up to this point were gigantic blockbusters sort of apersonal.
Yeah,
like it had a lot of his personal vision and like things that he liked, but he was particularly nervous about this movie because it was something that was related directly to his life and there's a lot of autobiographical parts in it and he was nervous about doing that because of what you said, like he didn't feel like part of it and it was like, do I want to be this much represented in my own work or do I want to continue to just make, you know, Jaws and Raiders?
He's still battling it. And remember, this is only 5 years in from when he like got put on the map, you know, like 77 was only 5 years before this.
75 was Jaws.
75, that's right. So yeah, so.
And this was 82, is that
82,
right? Yeah.
So 7 years into fame.
And knowing that divorce thing, I guess I didn't know it, and it really makes the emphasis of the movie make a lot more sense to me because usually when you have like the government chasing after an alien in a movie, it's very ominous. And like the government in this movie felt like, watching it as an adult especially, it felt like a couple of guys with a van. Like it's not imposing government
force.
They're
not super sinister.
And all the sadness and all the weight is on the dad being in Mexico and the divorce. And like that's the scary and horrifying part. The government showing up. They just have like some plastic wrap. They're not a very
right. And the metaphorical divorce from his own culture. E.T. as a protagonist, if you look at it like that, as opposed to Elliot, he's divorced from his own.
Wow.
Home. Elliot kind of doesn't belong.
So
either,
so they're kind of they're co-authoring the protagonist role. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah.
Sharing the same kind of loss.
Right. Yeah. They're both aliens in a different kind of sense.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Super deep, bro.
We like to keep it deep here.
But yeah,
CMC.
Interestingly, like this was sort of getting developed as a very different idea. This was going to be originally a horror movie called Night Skies.
And that's a good horror title.
Oh yeah,
that's solid.
And it was like an idea, you know. So it's kind of the basic premise is pretty much what Signs wound up being, where it's like a bunch of aliens are terrorizing one family that are trapped inside this farmhouse. And he had a script written up by, I think, John Sayles. The project just never, he kind of soured on it. And he just wound up developing ideas from it into E.T. Because in the Night Skies script, there was one friendly alien who befriends like the little kid in the trapped family. And then he took a lot of the horror elements and spun that into Poltergeist.
Oh, wow. Okay. And did Poltergeist come out around when E.T. came out? Wasn't that a thing where they were?
Yes. Yeah. I think it came out the same year.
Same year.
Yeah. And it was like two. Abe, you've talked about this before.
Yeah.
how it's two sides of suburbia.
Yeah, yeah. He talked about one of the films being about his about being a child and one about being a man. Like it's like he's like when you're a child, the fear of growing up kind of thing. Like it's how he had a nightmare and he had a dream, and this one was the dream. Poltergeist was the nightmare. Yeah. If it wasn't clear.
And Poltergeist is much more about like a father and then a child that gets lost.
Yeah.
Spielberg is so cool because like when I think about that stuff, I just get sad. And he's like, I'm gonna make two blockbusters out of it.
Yeah, he's the literal best of us. Like to me, if I were to send a human to aliens to be like, here's who we are, I would send Spielberg.
That guy.
He's a perfect storyteller. He's straight edge, so he's not gonna like show us the worst parts of ourselves. He's not gonna be like riddled with addiction like the rest of us. He's like this guy who's like gives to charity all the time, became super successful, knows what he's worth. He's a great guy.
Oh man, yeah. They talk about sending like, oh, we should send a poet to space. That yeah. There's the poet.
Yeah, there's
the poet.
Spielberg, baby.
Yeah.
Don't send Michael Bay. They'll.
Oh no.
They'll nuke the planet. Oh,
no. Right. He'll blow up space.
Right. Yeah. So while he was making Raiders, he was sort of putting the story together in his head, and he got a screenwriter named Melissa Matheson, who I think was dating Harrison Ford at the time. They would eventually be married. He got Melissa Matheson to work on a script for him while they were making Raiders. So he gave her basically story notes, and also similar to the way Raiders was written, lots and lots of hours of recorded just brainstorming, like recorded conversations, brainstorming the storyline for E.T., and he gave all that to her and asked her if she would write a draft for him, and she did. And pretty much that draft is what you see, not much else that was added to it. There's more, when he actually got into the filming, and I expect we'll talk about this a little bit later, there was more, he allowed for much more improvisation because he's working with child actors, and he wanted to capture that spontaneity of the way that children speak. You see this a lot of if you watch behind the scenes footage of a lot of Spielberg movies, when the writer's on set with them, like in between scenes, in between takes, he'll be talking with the writer about, okay, we should change these lines. What if we try these lines? You know, it'll just be like sort of they.
He seems very much like a guy who's like the idea in the room wins, kind of like that Pixar philosophy of it doesn't matter where the ideas come from, the best idea wins. Ideas can't.
Right. And that openness makes him look good, like or makes the movies good. Is the main thing.
Yeah.
Like that's great. That's fantastic.
It's a great collaborative spirit.
And consequently, because obviously for two reasons, one, because it's a movie made by Spielberg and they had just got done making Raiders together. And two, because Melissa Matheson was on set and was the screenwriter, Harrison Ford had a cameo in E.T. as Elliot's principal.
Right.
And after the big scene where he gets drunk and kisses the girl in class, like there was a scene where he got sent to Harrison Ford's office and got scolded, but they cut it out of the movie.
You say you don't know why you did these things.
But I'm sorry, I'll never do them again.
I see you fine young people from good homes, every advantage, your whole life laid out in front of you. And I see the pot, the pills, the angel wings. Sure, it's a cruel world out there. Deceit. Treachery. I wouldn't lie to you, son. See, you're in a way your own best friend or your own worst enemy.
That would have been immensely distracting if he was in the movie.
That might have been
briefly.
Why they
got I don't like that. Well, it's like, because like just dropping into it in the future when I remember seeing Apocalypse Now for the first time and Harrison Ford's just like unspooling exposition in that one scene in the beginning.
Yeah.
And as a kid, I was like, is Han Solo going to keep being in the movie?
Right.
Right. Like, yeah. He immediately
he's
like.
He's so important.
But anyway, yeah.
I do love that movie.
That might have been why they cut him out. Because it would be coming out a year after Raiders, so they should be like Indy,
Indy,
right? Just like Indy, like it's Smitty. Like Luke Skywalker's the janitor, and it's not. You can't do that.
E.T. has a romantic interest in Yoda.
Well, Yoda's in the movie.
Yeah, the kid does a Yoda impression.
The kid is in the. He walks by and E.T. recognizes Yoda, which is a whole thing.
That's canon, and I'm sad.
I know, because it was just like a funny little.
Yeah, I mean, I understand because they were both like at the top of the world at that time.
Yeah,
like, they're both are like kings, and so they're like
Lucas more so
than fellow king.
Yeah, Lucas more so than Spielberg at this point.
Yes,
but
very much so.
Yeah. Well, this was also, I really appreciated the cast in this movie because it was people that I didn't recognize from anything, right. Which is partly on me. But also everybody felt very natural and very good. And it's probably partly that approach he took to the kids where he let them do
whatever. I think Drew Barrymore had only done one other movie before. This was like her big breakout movie. Dee Wallace, who plays the mother, was somebody that they had auditioned for Raiders to play Marion. And he does that frequently, Spielberg does, where somebody, like, I think Joseph Mazzello, who's the little boy in Jurassic Park, auditioned for Hook and didn't get it. So he's like, well, I'll put you in the next one. And the rest of the kids, I mean, I think the story was he auditioned something like 100 kids for Elliot and Henry Thomas.
You see the Henry Thomas audition video? It's on YouTube for our viewers.
No, I haven't seen listeners. It.
It's actually fantastic because basically it's, I forget which scene it is, but he's trying to get him to cry. Like, you just lost someone. And it's like, you hear over the shoulder of the camera, Spielberg talking at Henry Thomas saying like, all right, now keep going.
Well, he's mine and he lives with me and he likes me. And he wants to stay here. He likes it here.
Well, we wouldn't hurt him or anything. All we want to do is talk to him.
But I don't want you to take him away.
You know, I've had to talk to your mom about it, and she knows that the government has the right to do it.
And who told you all this?
Well, we learned about it. We know that he's somewhere around here. I mean, I do have a search warrant. I could look around the house.
Tell me to keep the eye. Right. Tell me to keep. Okay, kid, you got the job.
That's a cool thing to get to do as a director.
It's also good, I'm sure, for that was a very important moment for Spielberg also, just because he just made a kid cry.
Yeah.
That's a part of auditions that only a director kind of knows, is that you have to see 100 of those kids, make them cry at you, and then tell them goodbye. So at least one time he got to say something positive.
Yeah, there's some footage where you can see it's after the scene where E.T. dies and it's Drew Barrymore crying, and it takes her a minute to get put back together. And he's like, you know, he's sitting there like, you know, patting her on the shoulders and everything, and he's like, this is
work.
This is what you do.
This is what happens. This is my job.
Time to make the tears. Maybe it's a thing like where directors are like, I wouldn't make anybody do anything I wouldn't do. So like, since it's so personal to him, he's like, yeah, I went through it. Yeah, they can do it too.
You're gonna be fucking sad too. I watched an alien die in my house.
Was it Verhoeven that like went buck naked in order to shoot the Starship Troopers?
Yes.
All nude scene.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So directors do that.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I wouldn't. I'd be like, I'm paying you to do this. Do you disagree? We'll talk. We'll renegotiate. I'm pretty ruthless. That's what they say. Old ruthless Abe.
Ruthless Abe.
Let's keep going.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, something about the financing and scripting I thought was interesting. We both kind of highlighted it, apropos of nothing. Columbia Pictures, which was producing Night Skies.
Right, yeah, they were attached to make Night Skies, the horror movie that he was going to do.
So when they passed on it, and they called it a, quote, wimpy Walt Disney movie, you know, that old, just decrepit Walt Disney who never could shake two coins together.
Well, Disney was in trouble at the time.
So Spielberg approached MCA.
So
it was that 80s time when none of their animated stuff worked out.
Their animated stuff wasn't working. Their live action family movies weren't working. Like, Spielberg had a quote where he said Disney was kind of a stigma in the early 80s. So having somebody refer to his film as a Disney movie wasn't great. And that was part of the risk of making this movie. So movies made directly for children weren't doing well. Another reason why Columbia passed on it is because they had already agreed to make John Carpenter's Starman.
Oh,
with Jeff Bridges. So they're like, well, we don't want to do two alien movies. We're going to go more toward the adult one. And I mean, obviously, E.T. would have been the better choice for them. But Starman wasn't a bad choice either because it was like a good movie. And it got Jeff Bridges, I think, his first Academy Award nomination.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But regardless, they passed on it. So we're in the period where somebody would pass on a Spielberg movie. Right. Where they're going to be like, get the fuck out of here with your alien bullshit. But they still had him under contract for this project. So they were gracious enough to allow him to shop the movie around to other people. So he took it to Sid Sheinberg, who he knew already, who was the head of Universal, because he made Jaws with him.
Yep.
And they were like, yeah, sure, we'll give you a couple bucks to make this movie.
Interesting note, like all the all the things that they had to do in order to make this movie, they reached out to candy companies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Apparently in the script, or at least the first candy they tried, was M&M's rather than Reese's Pieces to feed to E.T. And Mars was like, nope, we think E.T. is going to scare children. So they were right about that, but they were also very wrong about allowing E.T. to eat handfuls, just really weird skeletal fistfuls of M&M's. Because yep. Reese's made so much goddamn money off that.
And in fact, the Hershey's Company profits rose 65% due to its prominent use of Reese's Pieces.
Well, and I assume Reese's wasn't even in the M&M type candy business, right? They were just the cups, and then this movie launched them as a pieces.
Well, they existed.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think Reese,
but like as a major thing,
right? Yeah, yeah. That, they definitely weren't hanging in there. Definitely weren't competing.
Right.
I wanted to talk about the voice work of E.T.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, well, I have a broad question about...
Yeah, what's up?
Like, because I, knowing some things about effects, but not a lot, I was very curious how they were doing the E.T. Like, was it a puppet, or was it a person in the suit, or was it seemed to be... It was hard to tell exactly what they were doing.
All of both, both, actually.
Yeah.
Some slight animatronics for some of the nuanced expressions, but more or less there was... people in the suit.
Okay, so they went out hiring people to be in the suit.
Yeah, there were two actors, and also who would portray E.T. in like his walking scenes, and you'd see him walking. There was also they hired a 12-year-old legless boy.
A 12-year-old legless boy.
Yeah, he had like developed. He could walk on his hands really well, so they would have him do scenes. Yeah, so he would be in the suit like for the whole sequence where E.T. is drunk and kind of stumbling around the kitchen and falling over. That's the kid walking on his hands. He had gotten really good at just being like a clown performer, basically on his hands.
Okay, so now there's two movies I want to see. One of them is just about this performer,
right?
And then the other one, because you reminded me of that scene, is the like product placement talk with the Coors people, where they were like, "We should be the beer of getting an alien
right,
drunk."
We should.
That's definitely
the first thing.
our brand.
I tweeted about this like a couple of months back, but the first thing E.T. does when he's left home by himself is immediately drink 6 beers.
Yeah.
He tries one bit of potato salad and then drinks
like,
6
fuck
beers.
This. And he cracks a beer and he's like, oh yeah, I found it. This is it.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the scenes that Abe was talking about where the expressive animatronic puppet, the E.T.'s hands are being performed by a professional mime named Caprice Roth, who is laying down basically in front of the E.T. puppet with her arms up in front of him, so it looks like it's E.T.'s arms. But in a lot of shots, it'll be like blocked by a table. So like when he's sitting in Elliot's room eating all the food, that's her under the table, like just laying down under the table, reaching her arms up so that it looks like E.T. And then the rest of E.T. is being operated by puppeteers and such.
That's amazing. So it's sort of like Jurassic Park, where for every shot, they're deciding what kind of puppetry or operation to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's
or
so cool.
Rather, you build a really cool aspect of a puppet, and then you choose to place the camera in a way that hides any of the bad stuff. Like, that's how they're approaching it, because, like, in the same way as you mentioned Jurassic Park, they were like, oh, that looks really realistic. The problem is we can't show feet when we do this, so this will be... how we do close-ups
this
on dinosaurs.
All the low angle shots.
And the same thing is, you know, so that's how you navigate the, is it a wide, is it a medium, is it a close-up. They kind of usually design a puppet for each or a robot for each. It's like one of those things that when you think about it, you go like, oh, yeah, there's really no other way to do it. But when you look outside and you see all the magic put together, it feels like... inherently genius. Important part about E.T. is the voice work.
Right.
Which was performed by Pat Welsh. And I didn't know this before I was researching it. She smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day. Gave her a voice, a quality.
Yeah. It gave her that alien growling quality.
Yeah. And that's why Ben Burtt liked her.
Yeah. Ben Burtt is the sound designer for the film who came back from Raiders.
Oh, baby. We love Ben Burtt.
King of sound.
Did all the lightsaber sounds and everything. He'll probably come up a lot on this podcast. But yeah, Pat Welsh is just somebody he knew, apparently. She was not an actress. She was just an elderly lady who smoked a lot. He's like, hey, she sounds like an alien. And then he took her basically reading all the lines and then would mix in a bunch of other sounds. I think his total library for E.T. was 18 different sources, including an actress named Deborah Winger, who was somebody else who auditioned. Yeah.
Deborah Winger from Officer and Gentleman.
Yeah. Yep. She had also auditioned for Marion in Raiders of the Lost Ark. So Spielberg was like, hey, you're going to come back and growl as an alien for me. Spielberg himself, also various growls and grunts from animals like raccoons and horses. One of Ben Burtt's old film school professors burping for one of them. So he just, it's the same Ben Burtt bullshit where he just takes like, here's a bunch of random, stupid, weird sounds. Yeah. And I'm going to make an alien voice out of them.
She spent 9.5 hours recording her part.
That's Pat Welch.
A fact. I'm just dropping it in.
Seems like too long.
Not that interesting. What I find is, what I find interesting about that fact is it's coming. So 9.5 hours. That's really just a day of work. So she got paid $380 by Burt for all of her services. Now, what makes that interesting to me is that the voice and the icon of E.T., what E.T. sounds like, took $380. Yet the puppet took $1.5 million.
Whoa.
And lots of testing. Spielberg was adamant.
I mean, that's $1.5 million.
Yeah, yeah. Spielberg was adamant about testing every single E.T. animatronic because he didn't want to do Jaws again. He didn't want to have them where they built this really elaborate, delicate piece of machinery and it doesn't work. They drop it in the water and it breaks while they're filming.
I find that just fascinating because there's so many things that, like, when you go to the movies, you go see stories or you have a memorable experience witnessing any designed thing. It's like the character is a meld between the audiovisual experience. You cannot separate E.T. from E.T.'s voice. You cannot separate the look of E.T. from E.T., right? Yeah. Yet it's so like some things, like the charm, I guess, of E.T. is not just his animatronic movements and him being E.T. Visually, but also auditory. Like the audio space is very much, we all have an impression of E.T. that we can do. So, we talked about the voice earlier in this podcast.
Hello, I'm E.T.
I'm E.T.
Hey, I'm E.T. I need to get back home.
Get my 6 beers. But we all dwell on that. And it, just when you look at the filmmakers, $380, $1.5 million. Like, that, it's just
I could have paid for E.T.'s voice.
Yeah.
That's a hideous voice, too. It's a terrifying voice as a child.
Yeah.
Like, Eminem's is right on the money about E.T. scaring children, because he scares the shit out of most children
I know.
He
does not look good.
No, he doesn't look great. He doesn't look great. The design came from looking at a bunch of eyes. Like, Spielberg started with the eyes. He wanted the E.T. to be built around a set of expressive elderly eyes. I think Albert Einstein is one of the references for the eyes. Yeah. So he had that, and also the fact that Spielberg considers E.T. to be a plant. Like, he thinks E.T. is a plant. Like a space plant.
Oh, like biologically.
Yeah. Biologically is a plant. And that, like...
What?
Yeah.
Like he's a big potato or something?
Basically.
Yeah, it's one of those thoughts that, like... But... If we didn't know that Spielberg was straight edge, like, I would be like, that's drugs, man. That's just drugs.
That's some.
I think it's just one of those things where they just wanted that sci-fi element, so they just want to keep bringing things into relevance. It's like, but stop. Hold on, there's more. Kind of.
Speaking of design, he had Ralph McQuarrie of Star Wars fame, did a lot of design work on Star Wars, design E.T.'s spaceship. With this, the only instructions he gave Ralph McQuarrie was like, make it weird. Make it Seussian. Which is kind of why it looks like this. Like, it looks like a Dr. Seuss spaceship.
Yeah, it looks like a bulb on the top of a tower.
Yeah, yeah, it's with fun. Like little arms sticking out of it. It looks like looks like a Dr. Seuss thing.
And after Close Encounters, like spaceships, I don't know. It felt very similar to me
to the Close Encounters.
Yeah,
yeah, kind of.
Except like there's a lot more tone. Obviously, like the opening scene where the door's already open and stuff. It definitely feels more creepy, but there's something about, like, he clearly has, this is pre-ID4, so, like, we don't have gritty spaceships. We have, like, these magical, like, the Earth that stood still kind of versions of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe, I would argue,
We got that space torture museum that is Alien. I don't know what's going on in that spaceship.
Ridley Scott or John Carpenter changed the game, it appears.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of which, the same guy, Carlo Rambaldi, I think is his name, designed the alien head mechanism for Ridley Scott's Alien. He also was the one who designed E.T.
Yeah.
Oh.
Fucking.
He's the guy that built E.T. My mistake.
Yeah.
He built the E.T. Animatronic.
He has a lot of range.
Yeah, those are two very different things. You know Issa Rae from her hit HBO series Insecure. Now the first season of her acclaimed podcast Fruit is available for free. This gripping audio drama tells the story of X. He's an African-American pro football player on a journey of self-discovery and sexual exploration. Written and directed by Issa Rae, the Sarah Awards says Fruit raises the bar on what is possible in audio fiction. Listen to all of Fruit Season 1 now on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. Hear more of the story with Season 2 on Stitcher Premium. Just go to stitcherpremium.com/fruit. That's stitcherpremium.com/fruit. Universal's executives apparently were so... Nobody was anticipating this to be a hit. And they were so kind of removed from the process, so, like, not interested, not... Well, not interested, but they weren't, like, really watching what he was doing, that he didn't show anyone from Universal a cut of the film until they had a screening of it, of a pretty much completed film with John Williams' score and color correction, like all this technical stuff. It was basically done, and they screened it for studio executives and also an audience in, like, Dallas, I think. It was, like, maybe a month before the film actually, like, released in theaters.
Wow.
So he didn't show any... Nobody from Universal had seen the movie until he was done with it. Not a single frame. In retrospect, it's hilarious. There's a little bit of footage you can see behind the scenes where it's Spielberg talking with two other studio execs, and they're telling him what the competition for E.T. is going to be. And so they're telling him, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, which is a Steve Martin film.
Very different.
Yeah, and he's like, all right. And then they're like, okay, that's not really going to be a thing. And then they land on The Dark Crystal, and they're all like, oh, that's going to be some real competition. Yeah. And so they're sitting there, like, thinking about how they can make their film stand apart from Dark Crystal. And Spielberg was like, well, it's going to be fine because it's, like, they're only really similar because they're creating. And it's just funny to watch in, like, retrospect being like, nah, man, you're fine. Your Dark Crystal's not going to stand in E.T.'s way. Yeah.
In fact, the following year, E.T. surpassed Star Wars as the highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah.
So it did pretty well.
Yeah, it did pretty well. They got a private screening with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. John Williams must have felt like he was breaking his own records. You know, like,
he's
like,
crushing
when
it, yeah.
Like when Michael Phelps is in one Olympics just beating his own records the whole time.
Like. Yeah, because he did Jaws, was like, killed it. Star Wars, nailed it. Raiders, cool. And now it's E.T. All right.
Right.
Also,
just bursting into orchestra halls, like, you know who it is. Like, yeah. That would have been me if I was John Williams.
As we talked about a few times in this podcast, Spielberg is a staunch negotiator. He usually got merchandise as a part of the deal. You know, like, he got points, something that for their director at that point was very rare.
Yeah.
You know, you had to be somebody before you could be somebody. Like, points, Kubrick got points.
Real quick, like, points is a percentage of the film's gross.
Correct. Spielberg earned about $500,000 a day of days he worked on it by the end of, like, oh, by like the end of profits.
Average
like
it 19, out and everything?
Yeah, by 1983, he had gotten
it. Damn. It was only like 40 or 50 shooting days, right? It was a very short schedule.
$500,000 a day, though.
Man. Yeah, they made so much E.T. bullshit. Like, there's so many toys and stuff. And some of this really, like, there's like a light up E.T. finger, which is, like, real suspect.
Right.
Like, that's not the... Ugh. Maybe you should have had quality control a little harder on that one. One last kind of interesting fact about merchandising. You remember earlier we were talking about Melissa Matheson, who wrote the script. In her script, she pretty much designed E.T. She described a lot of his visual appearance, which is what would end up being used in the film. So she was able to use that successfully to receive a share of merchandising profits, and she had essentially designed the look of the character. She made some cheddar on that sweet E.T. merchandise.
Tom, I want you to talk about the sequel.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so there's a lot of pressure on Steven Spielberg to do a sequel to E.T. because it was the biggest movie of all time. You know, blowing away records left and right. So Universal's like, you should really think about doing a sequel. And he's like, I should really think about doing a sequel. Yeah. So they, like, sat down and tried to figure it out. And the closest they got was this weird story where the kids from the first, Elliot and Gertie and Michael, the older brother, get taken away by another group of aliens into space. And they are like, they're trying to contact E.T. and E.T.'s race of people to come help them. Like, that was the closest they got to an idea for a sequel. And then...
Don't like it.
Yeah, he eventually decided... I think the exact quote from Spielberg on doing that specific idea as a sequel is that it would have robbed the original film of its virginity. But yeah.
Steven.
A little gross hyperbole, but we get it.
It was a different time.
But so he comes back to Universal and is like, look, I think this movie, we can't do anything but make this worse. Like, I think this movie just needs to begin and end where it does. And yeah. They said, okay.
Oh,
which,
that's amazing.
Well, yeah, because he wasn't, I think at this point they could have just done it with this. He's still in a position in his career where Universal could have just been like, well, fuck you. We're going to do ET2 because right. They did it with Jaws, you know? We're just going to do it without you.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And to this day, haven't. I mean, I think there was a book that came out that was like ET and the Secret of the Green Place or whatever. That was like a sequel. Like, yeah.
ET and the Crystal Skull.
Sure. Yeah.
Hey, nobody reads books. It's fine.
Yeah, nobody reads books.
So that's how the movie was made. I would like to get into some observations. We have a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit. Secret Things.
Hidden Bullshit. This is where we kind of talk about things that you maybe wouldn't have noticed.
Yeah.
Things that maybe flew underneath the radar.
Things that, like weird trivia that we noticed that haven't been mentioned because they don't have a home. Also, symbolism.
Symbolism, filmmaking
yeah, that you
techniques
didn't notice.
That were deliberate.
Right.
Nah, I noticed everything. I think I caught it.
Mm.
I'll start.
Alex is a robot.
I'll start us off. Yeah. So in the school scene where E.T. is like at home watching The Quiet Man, which is that's the John Wayne film. E.T.
Yeah.
E.T. can clearly telepathically influence anyone he's connected with, in this case, Elliot, despite distance. Like, that can be at school,
yeah.
And it's instantaneous, and, like, emotionally, like, that's one of the things.
Because he's watching the movie, and then Elliot does the thing that John Wayne does in the movie.
So here's something I want to talk about. I thought that this was it's a perfect weapon for an invasion. Like, if you were a alien species...
It's a very vampiric relationship that E.T.
yeah,
has with Elliot.
That's what I'm getting at.
It's not great.
Yeah.
It's not great.
And I like, because we started off on the podcast talking about how they're like co-protagonists and like they're, you know, they're sharing the same kind of, yet they both kill each other by the end of the film, essentially.
Basically, yeah.
And come back to life. So this vampiric thing is not a good... Not so good.
And I had forgotten that aspect of it. Coming back to
it's,
it.
Yeah, it's a weird thing that you maybe... I don't think it ever clicked with me when I was a kid.
Right, and that's kind of scary to kids, or like, I guess not quite symbolism, but just like, looking into that, if you had a friend who, every time you were like around, like you slowly were dying...
Right, just draining the life out of you.
Like, that sends kind of a message to kids about friendship.
It does. I think you could also interpret it as being symbolic, since the movie is about divorce and kind of like the dark side of suburbia to a degree.
And a shared grief.
Yeah. So I think it's part of that is about letting go and moving on. Like what E.T. represents in a lot of ways. He could represent like prepubescent. It's like, okay, they have to move on separately from each other because they can't coexist.
Oh, that's a good way of saying it. I'm a
and
lot
it's
more
part
darker.
Of Elliot. Yeah, it's a little darker, but it's part of Elliot growing up and being able to move past whatever, like the alienation he's using as a crutch, basically, to get through his parents' divorce. So you can look at it that way.
Yeah, that's a very Blakean kind of interpretation of it.
It's like a maturity process.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I hope I don't turn, like, if that's maturity, then we're all turning into...
I don't want to turn into a white cat turd in a river like E.T.
Hey, speak for yourself.
Speak for yourself. Y'all, listeners,
wanted.
If you want to become a white turd, you can.
If you want to be a white piece of space shit. Related to something I wanted to point out was a deliberate choice in the film was, aside from the mom, Dee Wallace, who in some ways... is kind of on the same level as the kids. Like, they don't really behave like mom to her. They kind of behave like...
Yeah.
You don't see any adult from the waist up, or you don't... If you do, they're silhouetted. You don't see any adult's face until the third act of the film. They're like these...
Oh.
No adult aside from mom.
In this film in particular, but also in Hook, it's like a thing that he does a lot when he has children protagonists, or he... he did in JP, if you notice. You remember the scene where, like, Tim's running around trying to get in the Jeep, and he's like, whatever Jeep you're going to be in.
It's at, like, a
every
low.
Time we're it's always a low level because, so all of those camera heights are very low in this film.
That's so cool.
Well, and also, like I pointed out, when you do see the adults, they're silhouetted. They're all the agents of oppression in the film.
Yes, yeah.
They're all the aggressors. And the first person you see, the first non-mom adult's face who you see is Peter Coyote's Keys. The agent who by the end of the movie sort of, you know, quote unquote, becomes a kid. Like, he becomes a good guy at the end of the film because he saves the family from the government repercussions, supposedly, and lets E.T. escape.
Yeah, I remember there was an earlier bit in it where they're talking to a policeman and trying to get help with what's going on, just looking for people. Yeah. And you never see the policeman, really. Like, it's just kind of a shoulder in the foreground or something. You don't, like, see the guy.
And this folds nicely into our, you know, like, we basically have a running thesis now at this point, you and I, in terms of he just didn't want to grow up. Every film at this point still is kind of has something to say about man-child, you know, like, whether it's Richard Dreyfuss not admitting that he has responsibility, or it's E.T. where it's like, don't grow up, kids.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's pretty clear to Spielberg that, like, his childhood was pretty good and he wants us all to stay that way.
Would Attenborough and Jurassic Park fit that?
It talks about that. I mean, very much so.
Analog, yeah.
Like, look at Sam Neill's character, Alan Grant. His big arc is really just getting acclimated to the idea of children being okay. He's seen as an oppressor, and then he turns a leaf, and the leaf is being nice to children.
Yeah.
It's not one single thesis thought, but it's always just like all of his films navigate Hook. You know, like all of his films navigate around like there's innocence and there's experience, and it's messy and we don't like it. And sometimes it's better to be innocent. Sometimes you have to go through and get experience. So you at some point have to mature and don't be an asshole about it. You know, like, he has a lot of thoughts about that conversation. But he keeps saying the same thing more or less throughout his career, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. You know, Last Crusade.
Last Crusade.
A lot of his films are dealing with that. And it's interesting that according to Spielberg, he said that this movie was kind of what made him decide that he wanted to be a father making this movie, because he like Sam Neill in Jurassic Park, he's sort of being the de facto parent for this group of kids for a couple of months.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I can get into this. Like, I think I can do this.
Yeah.
Like, it was such a positive experience for him that he was like, yeah. And now he has like a million kids. Like, I forget how many. He's got a lot.
Oh, congratulations, Mr. Spielberg.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, because it's the same year, we're probably not going to do a podcast on it, but there was a commentary in one of the crit classes that I talked about, which seems like, all right, settle down. But in the end, it's kind of true, which is Poltergeist, the other film of this year. One of the reasons he thought it was a nightmare is he thought that it was very, during the time, there was a lot of conversation being had about, like, are TVs raising our children? Like, that was a big conversation, you know, like how, you know, two decades ago, it was like, are video games causing us to be violent? Like, so that was a cultural conversation. So that's why Poltergeist was exemplified by a television set.
That was around the time when the child abduction stuff and like kids on milk cartons
started, like
the John Walsh's kid.
Yeah.
Like, that was when that sort of hysteria hit the country. So it's about, you know, the movie's about an abducted child, basically. She's been kidnapped by ghosts, but still.
And so
parents' worst fear.
To me, I find that most interesting or relevant just in this year, or I guess, you know, the two previous years when he was working on it, the two movies that he was kind of excited about running and being a part of, were childhood movies about specifically, like, how can childhood go good? And how could it
go?
How can adults, like, be oppressors and you win, and adults be oppressors and you lose? You know, like, they're both pretty removed. Or, like, the father, the parent figures, the mother figures, they're all, like, seemingly against the kids, I guess is what I'm saying. That's kind of dark, Spielberg.
What's up, bro?
Yeah, what's up, bro? What were you going through?
Why so mad?
another interesting thing is the E.T. was the first major film that would had video piracy as an issue. Basically, the story goes that the public was becoming impatient at long delays of getting movies into cinema. Like, they would see that it's coming out, and then it would take forever. So an illegal group realized that this there was like a people watch the movie before the movie comes out, got a copy of it by bribing a projectionist, or at least this is how the story goes, and made it into a video, and the video was used as a master. It ran off a bunch of copies, and it became a cultural phenomenon. People passing VHS tapes to each other,
and it was VHS tapes at that time.
Yeah.
And E.T. didn't get an official VHS release until much later in the 80s, and
it was sold pretty wild, like illegally, but like it became a thing. People knew about it, and it was one of the first cases. It was one of the first films that everyone was like, "Oh, you can have a movie outside of a movie, like just have it." It's kind of cool.
I remember when they released E.T. on video cassette, it had one of the anti-piracy measures that they took. And it was probably influenced by this, was it had a green top.
Yep.
It had a little green, the top of it was green, so you knew that it was the official copy and not some cheesy
Spielberg's going to get this money.
Yeah. Movies kind of seems to be a somewhat of a recurring theme in Spielberg movies, is it's kind of, not necessarily anti-science, but looking at sort of progress as a slippery slope and not always great, because E.T. himself is like a spiritual empath. And then all the human scientists are like these kind of cold, detached vivisectionists who just want to cut him open or whatever. And E.T. himself doesn't have any, like, aside from the spaceship, he doesn't have any technology that we see. Like, he doesn't even wear clothes.
Yeah.
Like he just doesn't.
Unabashed nudist.
He doesn't have a communicator. or he just.
No, he phones home.
Right, with a Coke can and a coffee can and a speaking spell. Like, it's not...
One of our bad long lines should have been, like, nude drunk calls collect. Or something.
Naked drunk alien steals child's toys.
Yeah, other than his glowy heart and his glowy finger, he's just kind of shuffling around and occasionally extending his neck, right?
Like, all of his power is in, like, what he can, like...
I think you assume
that
all species think of technology as maybe their biology is why they are spacefaring. Maybe the glowy heart thing is enough.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
It also, and yeah, he builds a communicator out of junk. Like, it's like that one Star Trek where Spock, they're in the Great Depression, and Spock just like builds a way to communicate out of just old
MacGyver's
tubes and stuff.
It's
so adorable versus the evil government with their perfect plastic tent.
Yeah. City on the Edge of Forever.
And their fancy walkie-talkies.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about that yet.
The kids shooting walkie-talkies.
Yeah. Bang, 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 bang. Everyone knows that story.
Everybody knows that story.
Yeah. I thought there was a few critical comments that were said by critics once it came out that I thought were kind of salient or were lost on me until I was reading about them. One guy said Elliot, quote, suffers in his own way from the want of a home. I thought that was pretty cool because of going to the parallel kind of protagonist we are. And now it's the New York Times. Another critic said Elliot is the lost boy to E.T.'s Pan. Peter Pan, it's always told from Peter Pan's perspective. So he just visits these lost boy, this foreign child. So E.T. is the protagonist in the second one, I'd say. It's more focusing on, like, he had a little journey, and then he got back from Neverland, and Neverland is Earth for an alien. It's just this little vacation that he took.
The whole thing's like a Peter Pan remake.
Exactly.
They even fly around in a group.
They even fly around on a bike.
Yeah.
Never would have thought of that.
It's all about happy thoughts.
It's all about happy thoughts. Believing in
E.T.'s power is all based on, like, love.
Yeah, like food fights. Right.
Now I'd like to get into a segment we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed. These are additional scenes that, we think would have been either great or maybe not so great, but either way, we really want to see him in the movie.
Yeah, it might enhance the plot, might ruin everything.
I don't know. Just things we need some further exploration on. I think there's definitely a scene where the government either executes everyone in Elliot's neighborhood or throws them in federal prison for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, this is the pre-Men in Black Neuralizer era.
Yeah, this is what you gotta do. This is the Reagan 80s, man.
It's medieval.
The government's not fucking around.
I thought there should have been a scene where the local police talks to, like, the FBI, CIA, NSA, somebody. Because they just had first contact, and that's, like, a holy shit moment for, like, the world.
Yeah.
And so I know that we see them going into, like, there's tarps and stuff, and it's all, like, kind of hush-hush, you know, X-Files-y. But you can't hide that shit from, like, the local cops. Like, someone's going to be like, I have to talk to someone. I got to get out of this medical camp. Are we supposed to believe off screen? Or rather, there should be another scene that nullifies this if this is not true. But there's got to be, like, hush money happening.
Yeah. Well, because I had thought there could be a scene of the authorities explaining how, like, kids on bikes kicked their asses and got away from them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's an awkward...
So wait. What happened? You were gonna okay. You let the alien get stolen by a group of plucky children on bicycles, one of whom is C. Thomas Howell.
Yeah.
How dare you?
It's a great C. Thomas Howell poem.
Yeah.
He's super
definitely
fun.
What they would have said.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a shitty performance review. How'd they escape? Bikes.
Because I could see the boss being like, oh, so they just flew away from you magically. I see. Yeah. And then the cop has to be like, no, they rode away for like 10 minutes first.
Yeah.
Just was them on bikes versus me on cars. They were way better. Yeah, I couldn't catch them.
They almost didn't need to fly.
Yeah, pretty much.
They were spiking the ball at that point.
So we watched the movie. Now let's make some observations you may or may not have heard. Basically, any weird non-intuitive arguments about things about the movie. We call this segment, Let's Overthink It. Alex, you have a fan theory.
Yeah, I have a fan theory that this movie is a documentary, and it's a documentary about the actress Drew Barrymore's origin story. Right? Because, like, this little girl spends very, very formative years doing high-level pretending, right? Like pretending that they're not in the midst of an alien and that everything's fine. Right. And so after she came out of that, and like we talked about, the government has to like take everything apart. You know, they have to finish what they did. They need to like resettle these kids in whole new lives, like witness protection level, like kind of thing. And so they realize that she's gained the ability to become a tremendous actor in the process of this subterfuge with this alien. Mm. And so they set her up with the famous Barrymore acting family to make it plausible that she would have those acting skills as a youth. And then that's how we get the actress Drew Barrymore.
Form the dynasty.
Yeah.
Because of Alien.
So I looked at this little kid and was like, this intense experience has given this child the tools she will one day need to be in two Charlie's Angels films.
To be a leading actress in Hollywood.
I wanted to talk about something Abe was touching on with his John Wayne sequence in that the E.T.'s race is clearly prepping like a large scale, like doom bringing invasion, right? Because one, what are they doing there to begin with? Like they're just there, like poking at plants and like waddling around the redwoods, and then they get chased off by, like you said, dangerous humans.
Yeah.
Their guy spends like a week on Earth, nearly dies, discovers that the human race is especially susceptible to their vampiric telepathic abilities,
their
vampiric psychic abilities.
Right.
He calls them and they come back and pick him up. And all he's telling them are stories about how easily Earthlings' minds can be controlled and how they nearly killed him and cut his body apart for no reason.
Right.
Like, so this is a prequel to Independence Day, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
like they evolved slightly, got slightly smaller and slightly slimier and became the little aliens from Independence Day and then built themselves super suits and then just honed their psychic abilities and then built gigantic ships to come back and destroy them. Either way, like they were there on like a, let's see if this planet is suitable for conquering. They figured out, yeah, it is because we can live here. And also the people here are scumbags. Let's come back here and enslave the human race with our psychic powers and probably eat them.
Yeah.
There's no spacefaring race that is benevolent.
No.
You know, they're all in search of resources.
Like, they're not there for, like, joy. Like, they're not just they wouldn't just land on a planet to, like, be like, plants.
I mean, Carl Sagan famously disagrees with you, but he's wishful thinker.
He's dead and I'm not, wins that argument?
It's too soon. Carl Sagan's been dead for a long time. It's still too soon.
Well, then he lost the argument.
No, but I actually agree with you. And for some reason I keep having in my head, like, E.T. was a little, like, a younger kid or something.
Sure, he might have been one.
You see there's bigger E.T.s, is all I'm saying, when he goes back. So, I don't know. I could be making that up, but that's some next-level ruthless shit, if that's true.
Well, I mean, the movie...
Sending kids to scout... In 100,000 years, I mean, we're gonna destroy you.
Sure.
Even our children can scout your shit.
That's why they do it. So they disarm the human race and, like, oh, these guys are harmless. Because it's like outside of, like, the kids, like, everyone is mean as shit to E.T. So everything's threatening and horrible, and they have to hide him. And
He's constantly getting into hijinks.
He had a miserable time on Earth.
Yeah, but he's still, like. You know, he'll laugh about it later. Like, I don't know. The E.T.'s got this whimsy to him.
He'll laugh about it later.
Yeah, he's just like, that was a terrifying, you know, like, bike ride. But you know what? You're cool, Elliot.
Because he could have made them fly at any time.
That's true. Like, he's just sitting there. He's drinking. It's like playthings.
Yeah.
It's like he's playing. He's the equivalent of, like, a gamer walking into a virtual reality, like, public space. Like, just like, I'm going to fuck with this. And, like, who doesn't attack the chickens and
Zelda? Yeah, he's fucking with NPCs.
You know? Yeah, he's just like.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he's like, well, these bullets. I mean, obviously, I don't think bullets could kill him because he could make bikes fly. So you'd probably just be like, no. And bullets just fall out of the sky. So they're, like, in the middle of his bike ride. He's like, I'm going to blow these dudes' minds.
Yeah.
Just
like take a hit of this shit.
Like, that would have been my thing. Like, wow, we're flying. I'd have been like, you could have done this the whole time.
Yeah, there's so many applicable moments.
Yeah, we're being chased by police cars. I'm on a Huffy.
So we talked about how the movie was made, about some things were problematic. Mm. It was a good journey. I enjoyed going on it with you guys. I have a big question, though.
Me too, man.
We like to talk about whether or not this movie should go on the gold record that we send into space. Oh. Do we show this movie to aliens?
E.T.'s people are included in this race.
I know.
Yeah.
So do we show E.T. to E.T.?
I'm going to come out of the gate bold and say absolutely. It shows that one of our kids.
Yeah.
What?
It's a visual gag for the podcast audience, but sorry. Alex's eyes got very wide when you said absolutely.
Absolutely. Like... Hot take. I love that. I would say
the sound effect of my eyes boinging out.
Boing. Abe's got a hot take.
Like that cartoon wolf when he sees a lady.
I love it. I'm sad I missed that because I would have wanted to be there. I say absolutely. It shows that any one of our kids would save one of their kids or one of them. So regardless of whatever horror the human race has done, if they've witnessed, like we talk about in the abyss at one point, we were talking about how those jellyfish just like show an edited clip.
You have all the wars on the planet.
Yeah,
the
Green Day's Time of Your Life is playing, and they're like, yeah, you did all that good stuff. But
hope you
also
had the time
war,
of your life.
Yeah, you fuckers.
With this napalm,
you
piece of shit.
Bomb the shit out of people. So they may be aware of that.
And so jellyfish are hardcore.
And I'll totally assume that E.T.'s spacefaring race, they probably know some shit about us. But we take care of your alien children. So that to me would be enough that any spacefaring race would be like, these guys are, we shouldn't take them down because they protect their own.
I think I would have a slightly different read on that aspect of if I was an alien, because I think I would see the film and say, oh, children are clearly our allies and adults are clearly our enemies. So
it would become...
as an adult, we should not show this to aliens because the ETs and children will team up and destroy us.
Right. The aliens might not even understand that children and adults are the same species.
The great age
They may
war.
Think like the children are an entirely different race, like the Ewoks.
Right.
They're going to be like, well, we team up with the little ones.
The little ones.
And then we eat the big ones.
God,
Yeah, they're gonna
that's gonna be horrifying to them when they realize that the big ones turn into, or the little ones turn into big ones.
Right, it'll become a Logan's Run kind of government.
They'll be like, what have we done? We killed previous children.
Especially, okay, so right, there's that thing before where you said apparently E.T. is a plant, which I'm still not over.
Yeah, I'm not
can't figure that out.
No.
But also, like, plants spoil, you know? Like maybe they'll think, like, humans spoil when they get old.
We do.
That explains the whole thing.
We do kind of spoil.
No, but, like, before
it's
we
time
die.
Time zero,
like,
Alex.
Yeah, so I think we don't put it on the record because I'm a selfish adult.
And you think it'll be a great age war.
Yeah, it'll be a great age war if we let that happen.
Yeah.
I like that interpretation.
I think, no.
I don't like it. I just think it's
no, you don't show this to aliens. What is wrong with you? No! No!
Why not? Explain!
I'll tell you why
the rest
not.
Of the episode is just no.
No! Bad!
Because it's just like it would be like us sending them just a photo, like a Xerox of like our asshole and being like, fuck you, aliens! Because it's just us being
what?
As mean as possible to this alien. Like, the only people who are nice are the kids. Like, the government, like, our infrastructure is designed to respond to first contact with aliens by being just antiseptic jailers.
Yeah.
Like, our primary interest is what's going on inside this weird plant thing. And then, like, cut open his dead body and...
They wouldn't understand that that's, like, the thrill of discovery. The wondering of things, finding out what things are all about. Like, they're also scientists and voyagers, right?
It's true. How many people have they cut up?
They've cut up a shit ton.
I think it's safe in general not to show aliens any movie we make involving aliens. Because we never come off as the good guys.
Yeah. Is this the first one on the show where there's that, like, sort of, like, it's too relevant to aliens? There's aliens in the movie?
Yeah, this
seems,
is the first time
like it'll be a real thing.
Yes.
You know?
This will come up again.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess, like, I usually agree with you. And in previous podcasts, I say don't show it to anything because they may think of it as, like, a threat. You know, like,
you may not understand
we play
what
it on a...
I think that's how they would read this movie.
But to me, if there's any... There's only a handful of films that I would greenlight for this mission. E.T.'s one of them because it paints aliens in a good light. It paints us in a good light, you know? I don't know. Some of us. Yeah, you're right about the age thing, because adults don't come out well. But
although, we could also come off as very selfless if, like, we send this to aliens and it reaches a non-ET species, mm-hmm. and then they're like, oh, that's what those ETs can do. We're going to watch mm-hmm. out. We're going to build up our defenses.
That's true.
You know?
They might think we're
They'll be like,
the
thank
show.
You, humans, for the intel.
Other alien races use ET as propaganda against the ETs.
Look what they do to children.
Oh, my God. All right, so we're done here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's
before we go, we want to talk about how you can talk to us off the podcast. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with thoughts, people. We've been Abe, Tom, and Alex. Alex, where can we find you online?
Mostly on Cracked, please keep checking out this show because it's one of my favorite new shows that anybody's making anywhere.
Aw, thanks, buddy.
Well, we've been honored.
Really.
We're still figuring this stuff out.
We're still ironing out the kinks, but it's
feels good to me.
Hey,
yeah,
we're nailing it.
And thanks for having me. It's been
very
fun.
Where can we find you on Twitter?
I'm at Alex Schmitty.
Word.
Awesome.
I am at Start the Machine. Abe, where are you?
At Abe the Mighty.
All right. So you got a whole lot of Twitter homework to do, so go do it.
Go tweet, people.
Also, if you're an ET, we're very hard to find. Don't find us.
Yeah, please don't. Yeah, we're far too tall to factor into any of your benevolent plans of world domination. And make sure to come check us out again next Thursday when we'll be talking about another Spielberg film.
Which one?
Jaws.
Oh!
It's going to be the last one of the month, which is appropriate because it's the first real summer blockbuster. So be sure to listen to that. We're gonna jackjaw about Jaw.
And then listen to that podcast because we'll, spoiler alert, we'll tell you what new director we'll be talking about for
we're
the next
be
4 weeks.
Another month.
So tune
new
in.
August director.
All right.
So tune in for that. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You Humans, this is Matt Besser from Improv for Humans. It's an improvised podcast where we do a special thing every once in a while we call the narrative experiment, where we actually choose characters for our improvisers. They keep the character throughout the episode, and we basically do a sitcom. Check it out. It's called Mopes. It stars John Gapers, Jess McKinney, Eugene Cordero, three of my favorite improvisers. Check it out, Humans. Mopes on Improv for Humans.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.